Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. About half of America's farmland is planted with genetically engineered crops, principally corn, cotton, and soybeans. Genetic engineering allows scientists to change the genes in some farm animals and food crops to make them grow faster or bigger and be more resistant to bugs, weeds, and disease. Proponents say the technique holds the key to feeding an ever-increasing population in the most environmentally conservative way. Opponents say the science of biotechnology is moving too quickly, with neither adequate study nor precaution, and that we tinker with nature at our own peril. Do the benefits outweigh the risks? We'll get one scientist's perspective. Dr. Troy Ott is an advocate of GMOs and does work in the field. He's a Penn State professor of reproductive physiology in the College of Agricultural Sciences and associate director of the Huck Institutes of the Life Sciences. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, Patty. It's great to be with you and your listeners.
Depending on which camp you're in, genetically modified food creates both hope and anxiety. Nearly 90% of scientists believe that genetically modified foods are safe, compared with 37% of Americans who agree with them. And more startling, I think, than that is that 67% of those don't trust scientists on this subject, believing that they don't have a full understanding or a full grasp of the science behind it. And I should add that a lot of those people agree with scientists when it comes to climate change and humans' involvement in climate change. So how do you account for that deep mistrust or that disconnect?
Well, certainly you have really captured one of the essential elements of this discussion. As scientists who look at the data, we are constantly amazed at how much of a difference there is between what the scientific community says about the risks of these things and what the public perception is about the risks and benefits of genetically modified foods. And so I would say that if you want to know what the answer might be, I think if you would do a Google search for GMO food or GMO crops, what you see in the first many pages is a lot of misinformation. And so I think the answer is there is a lot of misinformation out there, and it's misinformation designed to scare and alarm people. And so I think that helps contribute to this great difference in between science and the general public.
Okay, so if it's misinformation that's designed to scare the public, who is responsible for that? Why would someone want to scare the public?
Well, it's difficult to get to be able to completely articulate everyone's justification for these things, but certainly there are groups that are philosophically against the idea of doing genetic modification. They just believe it shouldn't be done. And so in order to advance that idea, they will try to alarm people. I think there's some issues related to people that are selling non-GM food and trying to convince people to buy non-GMO food. It helps if you make it seem like maybe the GM food is dangerous.
You know, on the one hand, you've got organic food, for example, mm-hmm. and of course, advertising that their food is non-GMO. Mm-hmm. On the other side, you've got big companies like Monsanto, which is selling the genetically modified seed and the herbicide mm-hmm. or pesticide that goes along with it. And then you also have some scientists, you know, the vast majority agree that it's safe, but you do have some scientists who say it's moving too fast mm-hmm. and we don't know. We're talking about one of the most powerful technologies in human history, mm-hmm. and it's moving so quickly. 95% of the corn and soybean and alfalfa grown in this country is genetically modified.
Well, let's take the first part of that about it being relatively new. Many people don't know that genetic modification has been going on for a long time. And if we just accept the fact, since people have been conducting agriculture, we've been genetically modifying the plants and animals, and we've been doing this for thousands of years. The crops that we eat are nothing like the crops, their wild relatives, even if they even exist anymore. Same thing with the animals. But even if you look back into the more recent past, in the 1940s and 50s, when we understood that DNA controlled traits, we did things like just randomly modify the DNA using things like chemicals and radiation to just randomly make changes and see if any of those turned out to be good. This is a very sort of crude and slow process, but there's over 1,600 foods that we currently eat happily that have been genetically modified with this sort of random approach.
A pink grapefruit might be an example. It wasn't always pink.
The ruby red grapefruit is a classic example of a fruit that exists because of a random approach and then screening many, many of the resulting plants to see which ones had the kinds of traits that we wanted. In the 70s and 80s, we understood by basically scientists looked at the natural world and they saw there was a lot of gene swapping going on between viruses and bacteria, between viruses and mammalian species. So they realized that this was happening all the time. And as soon as they saw this happening in the natural world, they say, well, we could do this then in the laboratory. And that then started an era of a much more precise approach to genetic modification.
You say, in fact, that we can change a gene in an organism much the way we edit a word in a Word document. For example, War and Peace, mm-hmm. If you want to change man to woman, it's a click of a button. You can do it that simply with plants.
Yeah.
And animals.
And animals. And in fact, this last year in 2015, the scientific breakthrough of the year was given to the technology that allows this sort of precise gene editing to occur. So the scientific community recognized how powerful and how precise this new technology was. And so, yes, absolutely, you can do that.
Powerful and precise. But the problem I think that a lot of people see is because these genetically modified organisms have proliferated so broadly, mm-hmm. and because they are living organisms, mm-hmm. they can change, they can mutate. Mm-hmm. And because of things like pollen drift, a BT cornfield can drift, and so someone who doesn't want BT corn suddenly has seed that's been contaminated.
Yeah, and there are very clear recommendations if a conventional farmer is farming next to an organic farmer, there's very clear recommendations to leave buffer strips, and it's in the neighborhood of less than 100 feet to ensure that any pollen doesn't drift over and contaminate a nearby.
Who is the onus on in that scenario?
I believe it's on the person growing the genetically modified crop. So those concerns, which have been, I would say, really elevated, we don't see a ton of that problem happening. There are real easy solutions. These are not complex solutions. If we have an organic farmer next to a conventional farmer, they just need to work together and leave space so they don't, one of the crops doesn't drift into the others.
Well, you know, when you say it's simple, that brings me to this whole labeling issue. Mm. And the part of the argument is that it would be so cumbersome to store the genetically modified corn one way and the conventionally grown corn another. Mm. And yet, in a way, that's what a genetically modified, you know, farmers who are using this technology need to do, because for the most part, these crops have been approved for animal feed, but not in humans. And yet it has happened, for example, that genetically modified corn has ended up in corn shells at Taco Bell.
No, I think that these have been approved for use and consumption. In fact, about 70-80% of the processed foods that you'll find at the supermarket will have some GM.
But isn't that because of oils and things that are considered additives?
Flours, corn flour, canola oil, soybean oil, other products from soybeans. Yeah, so that's been in our food supply as long as we've had GM approval. So it's not these are approved for use in animals. These are approved for use and consumption.
So why was it an issue then that BT corn ended up in Taco Bell's corn shells?
Yeah, and I don't remember specifically about that incident, so I don't think I want to comment specifically on that incident, but perhaps they had thought they had a supplier that was a non-GM variety and they found a GM variety. But I think we have to come back to what is the actual concern here. The people that want to sell a GM-free food need to be able to differentiate that from the market and keep it separate so there's no contamination, and we have mechanisms for that. But beyond that, you started off with a question about labeling. If I gave you a food product, and it said produced using GM technology, what do you actually know?
Well, what do you know when we label something that says immune support or grown with love? I mean,
yeah.
we've got labels that say, all kinds of things.
Absolutely.
But I guess with that label, while it might not convey whether it's safe or not safe, it may convey to me how something was grown. For instance, I may choose to buy fair trade chocolate or coffee because of a value.
Yeah. And so,
and I can't do that if I don't know if it's a GM product or not.
Sure, you can. I think there is some confusion. If you want to completely avoid GM food, you have several options. You could buy organic food, or you can buy food certified by a third party certifying agent. So you can, if you look at the packaging, there's all kinds of labels on there now. In fact, you might have to take 10 or 15 minutes to read all the things that are claimed. But the government has said, we're going to put things on the label. We're going to mandate companies put things on related to the composition of the food or any health or safety or allergenicity issues. And the other claims are all voluntary. So there's nothing stopping any company right now from putting any sort of label and even getting a certification. So organic is a certification that's a fairly well-respected certification. So if someone wants to avoid genetically modified foods, they can buy organic or they can buy something that's been certified by. So that's possible. What we're talking about, what's being discussed in labeling is mandated labeling on everything.
And what's the argument against it?
Against mandated labeling?
Against it. And I'll add that all 28 of the European Union countries mandate labeling. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there are three states in this country that mandate labeling.
Yeah.
Connecticut, Vermont, and Maine.
Yeah. And those laws haven't gone into effect yet, but they will this summer. And that's why there's a lot of interest in a piece of legislation right now that's going to try to make a consistent standard across the U.S. If you can imagine from a supplier standpoint, if you have a tractor trailer going up into New England with food, imagining having to differentiate, this one goes to Vermont, this one goes to Maine, this one goes to Rhode Island, it would put a tremendous cost into the food supply chain. But the countries that mandate labeling, the European Union, for example, they actually grow in the European Union one version of genetically modified corn, and they import a lot of our GM corn and soy, so they consume it. So the question about labeling is, what information do you have when you have a label, and whether putting these labels on actually gives the consumer any more information. And the other thing that's a little bit concerning is,
what about just the right to know?
Yeah, so when you ask people if you want a GM label, a large majority,
97% of Americans say they want it.
A large majority. But if you ask them a different way, if you say, is there anything else that you'd like on the label of food, only about 7% bring up GM. Now, if you ask the same question to people if they would like to know if vaccines were used in the raising of the meat, they also say yes. And if you ask them if we should label that traditional crossbreeding was used to generate this cultivar, they also say yes. So what the social sciences tells us is, when you ask someone, humans want to know things, and they say, absolutely, I want to know more. And so that's why you get this big number.
Okay, well, it's interesting, though, because we do label something that's irradiated. Mm-hmm. And scientists say that's safe. And yet the FDA has decided, or the USDA has decided, yes, this ought to be labeled. Yeah. What's the difference between that and genetically modified?
Yeah, and for a little while, we had a country of origin label as well. And so these labels, when you begin to put labels on that don't convey meaningful information about the health, safety, or composition of a food, then you go down, I think, a slippery slope of, what will we label? I mean, how many things is the government going to mandate that we label about the production process? Genetic modification of plants and animals, it's not a thing, it's a process. And so there's been some suggestions about ways to get around this. For people who want to know more, they've talked about putting a QR code on food where you just click
scan
it with
it.
Your phone, and you can find out the name of the person who picked it. And so I don't have a real dog in the fight of GM labeling. I think that a GM label, if you ask the people who are against GM technology, they have been quoted many times saying, if we can get a label, we can get people to be concerned, and we can get it banned. That is concerning to someone who would like decisions to be based on science.
Well, speaking of getting things banned, I think it was 2011 when BT wheat showed up in Oregon. And of course, Oregon exports about 90% of its wheat. And wheat, unlike corn and some other products, is mainly used for human consumption. Mm-hmm. Japan detected this BST wheat and banned its importation into the country.
Yeah, and it's still a mystery about how that happened.
Especially because testing on this BT wheat ended in 2001. So how did this end up? And this is one of the concerns that a lot of people express, that just because you quit working on this doesn't mean it's not now in the environment.
Yeah.
And getting that genie back in the bottle is not easy.
Well, just remember, BT, the Bacillus thuringiensis, is a widely used organic pesticide. Organic farmers spread the BT toxin over their plants as one of the pesticides they use. So there's not any concern about the health or safety of BT, and organic farmers use it widely as a pesticide. They just sprinkle it on the surface, whereas in BT crops,
it's built into the crop.
It's just one protein, one very specific protein that does.
You're not suggesting that the wheat was contaminated because of organic farming?
I don't have any idea. In fact, there was a recent report that they don't seem to understand. But in countries set their laws and approvals for each crop as they come out, and that's the way we should do this. Each crop should be evaluated based on its risks and benefits, and then countries will do this at different paces. So sometimes you have the U.S. approving something, but it didn't get approved in China yet, and then if it accidentally gets on a shipment and ends up in China, China's going to say, hey, stop. We didn't approve that yet. We're in the process of approving it. So it will create these sorts of things. Japan did not have an approval for that, so they were very upset. And so it does create some concerns. But the larger question here was, is there any health or safety concerns from that? And the answer is no. And the follow-up question is, what are the benefits of these technologies? And that's where we tend on the internet to see all about risks, which have not been substantiated, and they've been investigated very carefully.
I want to talk about some of the risks, but first I'm going to do a reset, and then I'm going to give you an opportunity to talk about the benefits. For those who are just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. The adoption of genetically engineered crops by U.S. farmers has increased steadily for more than 20 years, yet public opposition to GMOs remains strong. Here to talk about that is Dr. Troy Ott, Penn State Professor of Reproductive Physiology and Associate Director of the Huck Institutes of the Life Sciences. So from where you're sitting, what are the benefits, the promise of biotechnology?
There was a recent study published, a meta-analysis of the impacts of biotech crops on farmers and the environment. And it's pretty clear it results in a real reduction in the use of pesticides. It results in the reduction of tillage in some cases. In some cases, they don't have to plow, which has a benefit in terms of reduction in erosion.
Critics will say that there's a reduction in pesticides until the insects evolve, which happens every 3 to 5 years. So this puts the farmer in a position where he or she needs to use additional pesticides to control the pest, or has to buy a new seed, the new variety that has been developed to address this insect resistance.
Yeah. And in fact, there are, I think, at least a dozen different varieties of BT. And so if you identify resistance in your particular area, you can just swap out with another approved version as well. So yes, anytime you put pressure on an insect or a weed with one compound, they can over time develop resistance. But the technology to address that is already there. So a farmer can just switch the particular type of genetically modified crop, and then that pest is no longer resistant and it goes away. In fact, there was a study recently that showed that the BT crops have been so effective at reducing some of these pests that they've actually advocated that we can stop using them for a little while because it's knocked back these introduced, like the European corn borers, knocked it back so badly. And it's actually benefited some of the organic farmers because the pest populations have been reduced greatly.
There are also claims, though, that plants that weren't affected by glyphosate, for example, have exploded because they haven't had competition.
You're talking about glyphosate-resistant weeds.
Right.
Yeah. And so since we started using glyphosate widely. Now, glyphosate was approved in the 70s, and it's now off patent, so it's sold by many companies. But since we've introduced glyphosate-resistant crops in 1996, there has been a gradual increase in the number of glyphosate-resistant weeds. But if you look prior to when any GMO crops were on the market, we have hundreds of herbicide-resistant weeds out there. That's not unique to GMOs. We were using pesticides before, and weeds were developing resistance before. The great thing about glyphosate, in terms of its toxicity, it is really on the very low end of toxicity. So it's been able to replace some of these much more toxic pesticides that stay around in the environment for much longer. So it is a real step in the right direction. When it comes to BT, crops that used to have to be sprayed for insects don't have to be sprayed at all. So there's tremendous reduction in the spraying of pesticides. These benefits are real, and they improve the sustainability. The crop yields per acre have gone up. The questions with weed resistance and insect resistance are real, but we actually have solutions for those. Not solutions that we have to develop, but solutions that are already there and able to be deployed.
You mentioned a moment ago meta-analysis, and just last week, in fact, the British Journal of Nutrition released the results of a huge meta-analysis of organic food, which showed that Organic food is more nutritious than conventionally raised crops. For example, with meat and dairy, it has more omega-3 fatty acids. With things like carrots and broccoli, they have more micronutrients and a number of other things, and as much as 50%. And the theory is that because these plants have been stressed, when a carrot fly munches on a carrot, that plant reacts and produces an enzyme which is distasteful to the fly, and that results in better nutrition. How do you respond to that? So, I mean, the claim is often by the pro-GM camp that organics say they're more nutritious, but there's no evidence. And this seems to point to the fact that there is some evidence that in certain ways it is more nutritious.
Yeah. Well, so those are two slightly different issues, organic versus conventional, but you can wrap up GM into that. You know, I looked over the study, and one of the things that you'll notice pretty quickly, and let's just talk about milk, for example. They talk more omega-3 fats in milk. When cows are fed on pasture, they have higher omega-3 fats in
because
milk.
Because they're eating grass,
right. But if you look at the actual amount, is the amount that you would get from consuming that meaningful in terms of your physiology? And in those studies, they talked about percentage increases, because when you go from 0.1 to 0.2, you know, that's 100% increase, isn't it? But it's still very low. So one of the examples was, if you look at their claim about omega-3 milk, they compared that to, you would have to drink your entire weekly daily allowance. That's 21 glasses of full fat milk to get the same amount of omega-3s in a 6 to 8 ounce piece of salmon. So what we have is, we have groups out there trying to convince people that there are these superfoods that are going to have these things that are going to cure you of all that ails you. And they're leading people to think that a tiny, tiny difference is meaningful. And it really, there are a number of other studies that say these are essentially the same. What really affects the composition is what they were fed. So, for example, grass-fed beef has a different fatty acid profile, but the amount of that you would get if you ate a 6 ounce steak is not going to have a big impact on your physiology. And at the same time, you have to look at the effect, that production system. When you want to talk about sustainability, you want to talk about things like how much pesticide is used, is the ground tilled, how much greenhouse gas is produced per gallon of milk or per pound of meat.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think this is really interesting. When we talk about BST milk, it is true that BST cows reduce the impact of greenhouse gas. Mm-hmm. They also essentially have the same nutrient, essentially the same nutrient content as organically grown milk. But the UE report on animal welfare and the effects of BST states that its usage results in, quote, severe and unnecessary pain and suffering and distress for cows. Mm-hmm. And that there's a 40% reduction in fertility and a 55% increase in the development of lameness. And so I look at those numbers, I assume they're correct, and I say, wow, you get 11 to 16% more milk by giving your cows BST. Is it worth it?
Yeah.
With a 40% reduction in fertility and a 55% increase in lameness, I'm wondering what the numbers tell you.
And this is why reasonable people can be led down a path. There is absolutely no evidence to support those specific things you just told me. And in fact, you can use BST very effectively to increase milk production and to increase the conversion of feed to milk. And there's no evidence that it has a reduction in fertility. In fact, I was on a co-author on a publication in 2014 that actually looked at the effects of BST on fertility, and it actually improved it. Okay? So this is exactly why reasonable people can say, wow, we should be against this. There is no scientific support for that at all.
I read that Monsanto, even Monsanto studies, showed an increase in mastitis in cows that are injected with BST.
So
is that untrue?
Yes, it's untrue. Cows that produce more milk will have higher rates of mastitis. So if you think about the average cow in Pennsylvania, it produces about 22,000 pounds of milk in a year. But we have farms where the average cow produces 33,000 pounds. Whenever you produce more milk, whether it's because you're better at producing milk, you're genetically better, or whether the farmer's better at feeding you, there's an increase in mastitis. To put it in perspective, the difference in mastitis that you see is less than the difference in mastitis that you see when you go between summer milking, fall milking, winter milking, and spring milking. It's much less.
So you
less
say it's irrelevant.
It's irrelevant. But once again, almost all the time they try to tie it to something, and then they can try to make this thing appear to be a big deal when it isn't. So what science needs to do is provide people with perspective. We don't look at our job as to tell you what to do, but we want to make sure that people have the facts and so they can evaluate these things. And just like you and your research found many things that seem rock solid, strong statements, you know, they're just not supported by fact.
I read a transcript from Frontline that included an interview with a geneticist from Purdue University. I assume he was a credible guest. Yeah. He talked about genetically modifying salmon so that they grow bigger, faster. The result, he said, was that that bigger salmon ended up with 400% more matings than the average size salmon. But in the end, the offspring of that salmon, 44% more of the offspring died than with the conventional salmon.
So I'm not sure exactly what this person was referring to. The GM salmon that was just approved, the Aqua Advantage salmon, grows about twice as fast as its non-GM counterpart. It just has an extra salmon gene. It's an Atlantic salmon that has a gene from a Chinook salmon that lets it grow year-round. Those salmon are designed to be all females and sterile. You know, they can't breed once they're created, so they're not going to be creating offspring. And that is
what I'm talking about happened in the laboratory.
Yeah, and once again, you know, without seeing what the person was talking about, it's difficult to understand what the point was that they were making.
Okay, so one of the great promises of genetically modified food is that it is the safest and surest way of being able to feed our expanding population. By 2050, we'll have 3 billion more people, according to projections. Why GM to solve that problem? And then I'll provide some pushback.
Yeah, well, I think GM is just one solution. There are many solutions. And if you look at what's going on in the College of Agriculture, we take a holistic approach to agriculture from small organic agroecology and using technologies that have been proven to be safe and effective. When we go forward and try to meet this challenge of feeding 3 to 4 billion more people in the next 30 to 50 years, we want to have as many useful tools in the toolbox. GMOs aren't the answer to everything, but they are certainly an answer to many problems. And in fact, in some places that are struggling to feed their populations, some of these uses of GM technology have the ability to make them able to more effectively feed their populations.
In Africa, there's a problem with drought, of course, and so drought-resistant cultivars are really important. A recent study showed that conventionally raised corn crop, maize, was more effective than genetically modified corn in terms of drought resistance.
Yeah, so if that is in fact the case, then you should use the conventional crop, right? Once again, we have no desire to apply a technology where it's not effective, but I will tell you that they have genetically modified crops now that are tremendously resistant to drought and to floods. And so in places that struggle to feed themselves, oftentimes they deal with poor soils and extreme weather. So these are potential solutions, but we always want to deploy the technology that makes sense in the environment where we're going to deploy it. So one solution doesn't fit all.
But how do you respond to the statement that we already grow enough food to feed the world, that the real problem in the world is the distribution of food because of politics and war, and because 30% of the food we do produce ends up being wasted?
Yeah, that's a great point. And that provides us hope that we will be able to address feeding a growing world population, because if we could just reduce waste, we'd be better off. But going forward, the most recent projections I've seen are that the current increases in crop yields are not keeping up with population growth. And there's some real concern about whether we can produce enough food. And it's not just producing enough. We are trying to produce more food with less environmental impact. We need to have less of an environmental impact with our agriculture. So that's a double challenge. More food, maybe 70% more food, but less environmental impact.
And on that note, we are out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Troy Ott. He's a Penn State professor of reproductive physiology and associate director of the Huck Institutes of the Life Sciences. To hear other interviews in the Take Note series, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.